FOMO.
If I were to give you a magic box and you could put $1,000 in there and get $10,000 back a lot faster than you think, maybe not a minute, maybe not a day, but faster than you think, how hard and how would you work and how much would you put in that magic box? Well, that's what saving is in investing when you're young and the compounding effect. And all of these things go exactly against our instincts, our system, and our basic kind of anthropological sort of inclinations.
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis, and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out, and it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. Today is a special one because we have a guest who everybody loves. Seriously, when I tell people this guy is coming on the show or he's here today, people love him. It's really interesting, the love that people have for Scott Galloway. And we had a misfire before. He was supposed to come on the show. Logistical challenges made that impossible, but he is here today to talk about his new book, The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security. Now, if you don't know Scott, you've been living under a rock, but I will give you his bio. He's a professor at NYU Stern School of Business, where he teaches brand strategy, digital marketing, and many other things to second-year MBA students. A serial entrepreneur, he's founded 9 firms, including L2, Red Envelope, Profit, and Section 4. In 2012, he was named one of the world's 50 best business school professors by Poets and Quants. His Prof G and Pivot podcast, No Mercy, No Malice weekly blog, and Prof G YouTube channel reach millions worldwide. And I want to throw a little special shout out to close friends of mine, Tom Clark and his daughter Finley, who's actually my goddaughter, who knows Scott, and actually sort of Tom put us in touch along the way. So we were connected earlier along, and I think that sort of was a great way to start to get to know Scott and Finley, who is, I think, listening right now because she's a Scott fan like all of you. All right, and now on to official business. As you know, I'd like to start every episode with the same question. And the question is this: tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
I came to grips with the fact that I struggle with depression and anger. And I came to the realization that that was mostly a function of chemistry or something distinct from the reality of my life, which is wonderful. And that I think from that point forward, acknowledging it helped me recognize that nothing's as good or as bad as it seems, and just to be more forgiving of myself when I get down on myself, which I do a lot.
Yeah. You know, talking about expectations versus reality, I mean, this is what your new book delves into, The Algebra of Wealth, which we're going to talk about today. And it's an important book. It's a book it's funny. It's like those kinds of books that you wish you had gotten when you were 22 years old or 18 years old. So for those of you who are older, we're gonna give it to you now so you can start now. And for those of you who are younger, go out and buy it. But it's a book about generating wealth as a mean to an end, which is economic security. So I just want to start there. I mean, from your own perspective, what does wealth, economic wealth, mean at this point to our societies? Because it feels like if you look at the numbers, the expectation you're going to make as much as your parents, it used to be kind of a given. Now, around half of people make more than their parents did at 30. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the ground zero for what ails us in America, we don't like each other, the coarseness, the income inequality, the polarization. I think the ground zero for that is what you just mentioned, and that is for the first time in our history as a nation, a 30-year-old man or woman isn't doing as well as his or her parents were at 30. And it sounds mundane, but it's the entire shooting match. It's the social compact. Your society isn't working. If you play by the rules and you're a good person and your kids are good people and they play by the rules and do well, and they're not doing as well as you, something's wrong. That means all this, society, government, our institutions aren't working. And in America, money has become, it's always been important. I would argue it's never been more important. I think America becomes more like itself every day. And that is, if you have money now, it means that you get access to better health care, you can take care of your parents, provide extraordinary opportunities for your kids, that kids whose parents don't have money can't afford them. People want to know you. People find you fascinating. People want to have sex with you. Essentially, to have money in the United States is to be loved. And next to survival, the most important thing we all want is to be loved. So having money in the United States has literally kind of become almost everything. It's like over the, especially, you know, for everybody, but especially men, over the age of 30, no one cares as a man whether you're good looking or not. They just care if you're rich or not. And so it's become the metric increasingly around how people evaluate you and also the kind of life you can lead in a capitalist society. And then the question, the first part of the question is what is wealth? I kind of see it as what does rich mean? And I would describe, and I try to distill it down to like basic equations, but I think wealth is passive income that's greater than your burn. So my dad, between his Royal Navy pension fund, Social Security, and some yield he gets from some fixed income investments, he makes about $58,000 a year. He spends $48,000. My dad was Scottish, born during the Great Depression. He throws nickels around like they're manhole covers. Spends $48,000, makes $58,000. He's rich. His passive income is greater than his burn. I have another very close friend who is runs a large division of a large, iconic bulge bracket investment bank. He makes between $3 and $7 million a year based on the markets. Between his ex-wife, alimony, four kids, house in the Hamptons, fractional jet, master of the universe lifestyle, I don't think he saves a lot. And I can sense in his voice how stressed he is economically. I think he makes that much money and spends almost all of it, and some years more than all of it. He is not rich. So rich is a function of your discipline and the construct you set up in your own life.
Yeah, it's funny as you're talking about, you know, there's two things that you said there that really stuck out. The first is, you know, what does it mean to be rich in American society in terms of status? And this has always been part of our culture, whether it's Glengarry Glen Ross, whether it's Death of a Salesman, like these iconic books and movies where you have these strivers who are destroyed by the fact that they can't make it. So we always had that, but yet the mindset of America was one that we were an expanding pie. And so if you just kind of worked hard enough, you could get there. At the same time, you have this incredible situation where you have folks who are making tons of money, but because of the fact that they have life experiences or life extenuating circumstances, or they have tons of credit that they're unable to sort of live within their means. And I think that explosion of credit has meant that it's not just the rich banker with the house in the Hamptons, but it's like my cousin in Maine who has way too many things on a credit card, that you just have people where many years ago there was like people kind of live within their means. It was definitely like, you know, at least I'm in New England where I'm from, it was sort of like, you know, people just they had to, because they had no way of, they had to put things on layaway to buy them. Nowadays, people spend way more than they can. And as a result, it creates this microeconomic situations, like this gnawing insecurity in people that makes them angry and definitely less trusting in institutions than they might have been.
Yeah, there's a lot there. So we live in a deeply comparative society where every day you have shoved in your face several thousand times a week and based on algorithms showing you what you could have but don't. Someone is making more money than you. Someone is living a larger life than you, has a nicer home, has better taste than you, has a hotter boyfriend or girlfriend, and is sitting by a pool of a much more fabulous resort than you. Every day you're reminded of just that you're not doing as well as someone else. And, you know, we're a competitive species. That's what keeps striving us forward. It's important. But you also have, America is, I remember when I was backpacking through Europe after college, I was super excited because I changed $300 in traveler's checks. I'm dating myself for forints. I was going to Hungary. And they literally gave me a 5-inch stack of these forints. And I thought, finally, I can live large. And I went to the major shopping district thinking I was going to live large and buy a bunch of cool shit in Hungary. And I walked into one store that had this beautiful leather bag in the window. And she immediately said, leather bag not for sale. There was nothing to buy there. There was literally nothing to buy. On the flip side, American capitalism every day has amazing things that turns them from wants into needs. I was just at High Street. I live in London now in Marylebone. And it's true here. I went into this Italian bakery and they had the most beautiful works of art in the shape of cakes. I went to a florist shop, gorgeous, gorgeous flowers. I just tried on the citrus hand cream. I have no desire. I could give a shit about how moisturized my hands are. And I'm like, I have to have this citrus Aesop hand cream. I mean, the amount, and I thought on my way home, I'd really like to get groomed. And they have this place where they'll rub your neck and they use flame to take the hairs out of your ears. And I'm like, I have to do this. I mean, every day there's just so many amazing ways to spend money.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. And capitalism is fantastic at saying, no, upgrading from economy to economy comfort to economy plus to business class to first class to fractional jet to owning your jet. All of those things aren't consumption. They're positioned as investments. Investments in saving time so you can spend time with your family or signaling to others or being more productive. So the fight, and this is a key component of my book, the stoicism and discipline you need to apply in a capitalist economy such that you can, bottom line, you know, spend less than you earn, such that you can save money and start building an army of capital to work for you, it requires tremendous character. It requires tremendous discipline because I make a shit ton of money. I could easily spend all and more of it. There are so many amazing ways to spend money in our society. And no matter what you have, the algorithms are going to make sure to show you you're still not quite there, boss. You still could be doing better. There's never a point. I got to think, you know, I was in the West Palm Beach Harbor and I rolled out and I saw Eric Schmidt's boat. And just behind it was the boat that Steve Jobs was supposed to take delivery on. When I say boat, I mean yacht. And this thing was so cool. And I thought on the other side of Eric Schmidt's boat is Eric Schmidt sitting on the railing, looking at Steve Jobs' boat going, why the fuck don't I have that boat? So capitalism will always encourage people to spend money, which is great for the economy, but it takes real character and discipline not to spend all and more. Buy now, pay later. And they position it as if it's innovation. It's not innovation. It's a fucking trap for young people. What we need is more of a zeitgeist around invest now or save now and harvest later. But buy now, pay later is literally seen as innovation. No, it's not. So the deck is somewhat stacked against you a little bit in a capitalist society. It's like, how do you take advantage of the income earning opportunities and the strength and just the spectacular components of our economy while at a young age when your brain is least prepared to make these executive function decisions? How do you show the discipline to go, I'm young. I don't need to live in a nice place. I need to live near work in a place that has a bed 7 hours a night. That's it. Those are the only criteria. How do I gamify not spending money? And how do I do everything I can to start saving 100, 1,000, 10,000 bucks in my 20s? Because the other thing you need to tap into is something our species is terrible at, and that's calibrating time. The majority of people throughout the majority of our history as a species have not lived past 35. There's not a single 22-year-old alive right now who's ever been 65. So none of us at that age can ever imagine being 50, much less 60. Jesus Christ, are you kidding me? I'm actually going to be 60. It's literally unbelievable. But as someone who is getting near that age, what I can tell every young person, but they will not believe me, is it's going to happen faster than you think. Mm. And if I were to give you a magic box and you could put $1,000 in there and get 10,000 back a lot faster than you think, maybe not a minute, maybe not a day, but faster than you think, how hard and how would you work and how much would you put in that magic box? Well, that's what saving is and investing when you're young and the compounding effect. And all of these things go exactly against our instincts, our system, and our basic kind of anthropological sort of inclinations.
FOMO.
Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now that right there was Portuguese, and as you know, I love speaking foreign languages. But I'm not alone. One in five Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak four languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, or delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. And with rising prices everywhere you look, you gotta do the math and save money. Good news, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. So head over to netsuite.com/FOMO. That's netsuite.com/FOMO. netsuite.com/FOMO.
FOMO.
Well, the good news is you've given us an equation that I think, because as you talk about all of this, where it comes back to me is values. It's like, what matters to you? And if what matters to you is the sugar high of consumption and the emotion of buying Dogecoin and day trading that, like, you know, you need to, it's your life. But if you're looking for something more sustainable and you want to build wealth, then you've given us an equation, which I think is very values driven, which is your algebra of wealth, which is really, it's four things. It's focus plus parentheses, stoicism times time times diversification, close parentheses. So, you know, you're a professor, you've given us some math, but there's no numbers, it's words. So, you know, even better for me. And I'd love to get into some of the components of that. But before we do, just talk about that equation, sort of how did you come to it and what's, you know, how would you sort of describe it to us?
Well, I just thought, what a really, if you think about, there's a lot of research showing that if you have five or six friends, they all become the median or the mix or the average of those six people. They end up being the same weight. They end up being the same political party. They end up living in kind of, they have similar income levels. Where the variance is by the time they're 50 or 60, their wealth is dramatically different. Because even though they make the same, even though their behaviors are largely the same, some will incorporate some principles and some strategies where they end up with more wealth. And I tried to distill it down to the simplest pillars such that young people could do what I didn't do. And that is, I kept thinking, I'm a baller, I'm successful, I'm privileged. At some point, I'm going to get a $3, $5, $10, $20 million windfall. I was starting companies, trying to sell them, but never actually bothered to save, never actually bothered to spend less than I was making and save a little bit because that was for losers. I was a baller. At some point, I was going to hit really big. So the first thing is focus, and that is find your talent, not your passion. Your 20s are about workshopping to find something you're good at that you could potentially be great at. And here's the key part, in an industry that has a 90%+ employment rate, people mistake passions for careers. 87% of people in the SAG-AFTRA union, the unions representing actors, make less than $23,000 a year. There are basically 8 spots for basketball players. There are 14,000 amazing high school basketball players. You know, opening a restaurant, opening a club, anything that sounds cool, just keep in mind, the cooler it sounds, the lower the ROI. And if you are really that exceptionally talented, the market will let you know almost immediately. But 99% of us do not have the talent to make a good living in what I'll call the passion fields. Find a field where there's over 90% employment rate, and if you're good at it, then invest the grit, the bullshit, the endurance, the 10,000 hours to become great at it. And the accoutrements, the camaraderie, the prestige, the economic security, the ability to take care of your parents, your kids, the relevance, the admiration, will make you passionate about whatever it is. Nobody grows up thinking they want to be a tax lawyer. But my tax lawyer flies private because she advises some of the wealthiest people in America, and she is outstanding at what she can do. So she charges $1,800 an hour. And she didn't grow up probably thinking she was going to do that, but probably pretty early she said, I'm good dealing with clients. I have an exceptional understanding of the tax code. I am creative. People trust me. I'm good working with others in my law firm. I have the discipline to get certified, get a law degree, get a CFA, get a master's in tax. So focus. Find something you're good at. Two, realize that, back to the part about character, and I call it stoicism, although it's a little bit, that's not a perfect word for it, but your ability to spend less than you make. That is really hard. Really hard. And there's some simple tricks you can do. $10 a day, whether that's foregoing a coffee, rounding up with acorns or something like that. Start at $10 a day, but ultimately get to, you know, start at $10 a day. That's $300 a month. See if you can get to $1,000 a month. And if you can do it through your 20s, you just want to start getting, just like you damage the bicep every day, you'll get huge biceps. You want to damage your savings muscles every day, make little sacrifices, get used to saving and working out the savings muscle, and it'll get bigger and stronger. Because $1,000 saved at 22 is kind of more powerful than $10,000 saved at 42. So getting that stoicism and those saving muscles early. Diversification. The richest people that the media talks about and that you hear about were highly non-diversified. They had all their money in Microsoft or Meta. Assume you are not Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Ballmer. Diversify. Diversification is your Kevlar. I was going to be worth $30 million on the IPO of Red Envelope. I had everything and more in Red Envelope. We had a credit crisis. We had a war at the board. We had a factory mishap where we started sending gifts to the wrong addresses, and we had a longshoreman strike off the port of Long Beach, and within 2 weeks, we went from a stock trading at $7 to Chapter 11, and I lost 110% of my net worth. I should have been taking money off the table in secondaries, and I should have been diversifying. Diversification is your Kevlar. You can get shot in the chest, have an investment, a big investment go wrong, but it won't kill you if you're diversified. And over time, just investing in the S&P, low-cost index funds, is the way to get rich. It's absolutely the way to get rich. And then appreciating what no young person can appreciate, but understanding and recognizing it, and it goes against everything you know instinctually, you are probably going to live until your 80s or 90s, and it'll go faster than you think. So let compounding take over. Find your talent, something you can make good money at by being great at it. Try to spend less than you make. Deploy an army of capital, start small, work out that savings muscle. Diversification is your Kevlar. You don't need to be a hero. You don't have to find the needle in the haystack. Buy the whole haystack. Do not day trade. 85 to 95% of day traders lose money. It's gambling. It's not investing. It's gambling. And then finally have an appreciation for time. And so the good news is I absolutely know how to get you rich. The bad news is the answer is slowly. But if you follow these things, I can say with relative certainty that when you are older, which will go much faster than you think, you will have some level of economic security, whether or not you have that big baller win we're all hoping for. If that happens, great. But this is your plan B that turns into your plan A for most people. Most people never have a dramatic windfall, sell their company, buy Dogecoin at 10 cents and it goes to 30 bucks. It seems like that's happening to everybody because of Instagram. It happens to very few people. So make sure by following these steps, if that doesn't happen, you're still good, maybe even great.
FOMO. FOMO.
Yeah, the point which you make, and I think it's a really essential mindset shift, is you're not trying to be the richest one. Like, if that happens, great. But you're trying to generate wealth and to have the freedom that comes with that. And so that means trading off. Instead of going all in on one asset that is, you know, high risk, high return, diversifying away from that into, you know, the kind of stuff you just talked about. Now, I do want to hit one point here, which is, you know, talking about the focus point. And, you know, it's totally sensible advice. But, you know, we live in an economy now where it feels like everything that comes into fashion goes out pretty quickly. So, you know, my own experience, having worked in tech in the early 2000s, everything blew up. Then I got into private equity, working at the division of a company called AIG. Remember what happened there? Mm-hmm. Then I, you know, so it's like I've seen this with many of my friends and just a lot of people. It feels like you get into an industry that should be quite solid, and then the whole thing just blows up after a couple of years. Look at tech right now. Obviously, everybody knew it was overvalued, but there's so much paper wealth that was just blown out of the water. And so people are starting over, and we'll see it again with climate tech and AI probably. So as somebody who is trying to be focused, and they say, listen, I'm actually going out and getting the boring job in the industry. You know, I thought I was doing the right thing, but somehow I keep on kissing the frog. How would you approach that? What are your sort of lodestars for people to make sure that they don't get into the hot new thing and end up getting, you know, disappointed?
Yeah. So first off, you could probably go short, and I don't suggest you do this, but the most popular job of second year MBAs is because they're rear view looking.
Right.
They will go into whatever's hot, which means it's overinvested, which means the returns naturally get beaten down. What I would say is what you're suggesting a little bit is kind of chasing what's hot, as opposed to saying, all right, if you are in tech, was it because you were a great product manager? Was it because you were great at investor relations? Is it because you're a great coder? Because if you're good at one of those things, you want to go all in and become just great at it. You want to find something where just naturally you're kind of in the top median and say, I think if I really invested in this competence and this skill, I could become in the top decile, maybe even the top 1% one day. Private equity requires a certain, you know, certain skill set. You have to understand debt. You have to understand how to woo entrepreneurs to sell their private companies to you. You have to understand how to raise large sums of money from institutional investors. Those are all a skill set that can be applied to a number of industries. So if you say, you know what, I am great at raising money. I know how to meet with sovereign wealth funds, family offices, maintain relationships, sound compelling. I genuinely like people, so I enjoy spending time with them, because most of these things are, most people don't realize that first time you get a $3 or $5 million check, even from a multi-billion-dollar sovereign, you've probably met with them 30 or 40 times. And so you've got to like them. You've got to enjoy meeting people. You've got to be able to create, you've got to have a great salesmanship, be good at relationships. That skill, the ability to raise money, if you get great at it and you establish those relationships and those skills, you will always make a good living. It might not be in private equity. It might be in venture capital. It might be raising money for startups. It might be, I mean, there's just no shortage of jobs for people who know how to raise money. If the part of private equity is you know how to structure complicated debt structures, right? You know how to set up, you're great at deals. You just understand how to structure a deal that makes the entrepreneur happy, but at the same time, you'll accept certain covenants so you can go raise money. You know how to do a class. I mean, there's just so many different competences required in all of those things. So zero in on the competence and what you're great, you know, good at. Commit to being great at it. And I think when things come in and out of fashion, that's okay. You can ride it out because you're great at it. But are you doing something because you're really good at it, or because it's the hot thing? And when you're young, you do stuff because it's. Out of college, I went to work for Morgan Stanley. I could not tell you what they did. But my mom would be impressed, and I thought it would impress strange women. So I did it. I had no idea what investment banking was. Within 2 years, I was in the analyst program. I realized I was no good at it, and I didn't like it. I was never going to be in the top 10%, much less the top 1% of investment bankers. So I went back to business school. I started workshopping my career, and I found something I was reasonably good at and thought I could become great at it. But that's what your 20s is about. Finding something you could be great at and starting to exercise those savings muscles, which I did not do. My first bonus from Morgan Stanley, I got $35,000, which was a shit ton of money. I had never had anything but debt up until that point. I grew up raised by a single immigrant mother who lived and died a secretary. I immediately went out and bought a BMW 325i, hung swim goggles off the rearview mirror so I could say to women, have sex with me. I'm an athlete and I'm a baller at this young age. You should want to be around me, and I wanted to impress my guy friends. Had I bought a Hyundai, a used Hyundai for 10 grand and taken that extra 21 grand and put it in SPY, I think I'd have like $1.7 million now. I would really like that $1.7 million. But at that age, I could never imagine I was going to be this age. And what you want to do is try and figure out a way to go forward and talk to your future self. And your future self is going to be, okay, I recognize you in your mating years. I recognize that stuff is cool. But boss, millions of dollars when you're older is really awesome. Trust me on this. It's really awesome. And that's where the character part comes in. It's really hard. And I understand young people who want to buy nice things and do nice things. They want to live their life. They want to impress their friends. They want to signal to potential mates. I get that. But try and stretch that savings muscle even just a little bit, because just a little bit when you're young turns into a lot. Because here's your core competence, your core advantage as a young person, time. You got 40 or 50 years of compounding ahead of you.
You know, as somebody who was the worst investment banker at JP Morgan and did save his bonus, which I think I still have.
For you.
I mean, listen, it's I also grew up in a small town, so I get it. And I remember seeing a friend of mine put it all into the NASDAQ and right. And I just watched it all go away and he never recovered. So it's really good advice. Scott, I want to jump now to the lightning round. I got four quick questions for you before we wrap up. All right, so four quick questions. The first one is this. Give me a favorite quote.
Nothing's ever as good or as bad as it seems.
Yeah. Who said that, by the way?
No idea. It's like a truism. It's something that helps me stay humble and helps me get through periods of depression.
Yeah, I heard that. The last time I heard that besides you was Howard Marks, the great investor. And he was talking about the economy, of course, and he was right.
Yeah.
Number two. Name a book or podcast, not one of yours, that every FOMO sapien should know about.
The Alchemist by Paul Coelho. And I love The Daily by the New York Times. I just think they do a great job of going deep on stuff. That's probably the only podcast I listen to. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, you make a lot of podcasts. You get enough podcasts in your life.
That's right.
All right, number three. Well, we kind of answered this, but I'll ask you for another one. What's a piece of advice you give to your younger self?
Forgive yourself. Nobody you know, nobody you care about that cares about you is going to be alive in 100 years. When you fuck up, when you make a bad investment, when you're not as kind as you should have been, when someone you like doesn't like you back, mourn for 24 hours a week, maybe 30 days if you lose someone you love. And then do everything you can to forgive yourself and move on. The key to success is your ability to mourn and to move on.
Final one, what is your most important memory?
Well, I know what it is, but I always have to like steel myself because I get emotional talking about it. I was the commencement speaker at Berkeley and at the graduation, the student commencement speaker, which I realize is a flex. And my mom was dying of cancer. And I remember looking up and seeing her waving.
Thanks for sharing that. Really appreciate it. All right. The book, which and I don't read them all, but this one I read all of it. And I'm looking forward to gifting to people, is The Algebra of Wealth. Now, if you want to find out more about Scott's work, you can find his newsletter, which is called No Mercy, No Malice. He also prolifically records podcasts, The Prof G Show and Pivot. So go check that out. Again, the book is The Algebra of Wealth. Scott Galloway, thank you so much for being here.
Patrick, thanks so much and congratulations on your success. I keep hearing about this podcast, so well done.
Thanks. FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOSapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis, and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOSapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOSapiens.com.